everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are. It's the 7th of October, 2014. Yeah, this is World Vegetarian Month. We had World Vegetarian Day on October 1st, and now we're into the month, the Vegetarian Month, and November is World Vegan Month. Why not? We all need these holidays and special times to focus on what's important, and it's nice to have holidays, right? Although we really should be doing these things every day, and that's what we're going to be talking about in a moment. I'm going to bring on my first guest, Ann Dinshaw. She's been on this show a bunch of times before. She's co-authored the book Powerful Vegan Messages with her late father, American Vegan Society founder H.J. Dinshaw, who spearheaded the modern vegan movement in America, influencing many people with his message of dynamic harmlessness. And that's what we're talking about today, Dynamic Harmlessness Day. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Karen. Always great to join you.
Good. I just realized it's not easy saying harmlessness.
It isn't, but it's not easy to do it either sometimes. So we're just going to try and make it a little bit easier for people.
Right. Dynamic harmlessness. I've got to practice that harmlessness. It's kind of fun to say dynamic harmlessness.
It is. It's a great tongue twister. And when you have to define it as do the least harm and the most good, then it really sinks in with people.
Right. So Dynamic Harmlessness Day. What is it? Where can we find out more about it? And what should we be doing?
You want the answers to all of those at once?
Yes, all at once.
All at once. Well, the easiest way to get all the answers on Dynamic Harmlessness Day is to go to the AmericanVegan.org website. It's AmericanVegan.org/DHD for Dynamic Harmlessness Day. And we've got a lot of great information to inspire you of how to do the least harm and the most good on November 2nd, as well as every day of the year.
So Dynamic Harmlessness Day is November 2nd.
Yes.
It's the day after the official World Vegan Day.
It is.
And it also was your dad's birthday, right?
It was. Yeah, he just happened to be born on November 2nd, which is so appropriate because on November 1st, World Vegan Day, you're enjoying the bounty of plant foods and not doing your animal products anymore. And then you're wondering what's next. And so the next step on a vegan journey is to really learn about applying ahimsa in our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And ahimsa is the concept of non-harming. It's a Sanskrit word. And non-harming is a great idea, but if all we do is not harm, it's really missing something. And that's what he really put forth, was to do the positive action side of ahimsa as well and to figure out how to do the least amount of harm and the most good. Because you might do just a little bit of harm in creating a huge bounty of good, and not to dwell on the tiniest bit of harm. You just do the best you can and interact in society doing good things.
Yes, dynamic. It needs to be dynamic. It needs to be mindful. And if everybody was doing a little bit of this, it would be a beautiful place.
It would be. And so that's why one of the things that we've put up on our website are a lot of really cool quotes from my dad. Short ones, long ones, things that will inspire you to just try doing something a little bit different. And one of the ones that I really like, he said that we should recognize the advantages in our good actions, that it doesn't just help those to whom they're directed, but it also helps the doer, and you learn about your own character in what you're doing to help others. So it helps the world, it helps the individuals you're affecting, and it really helps yourself.
Okay, now your dad founded the American Vegan Society, and we're always talking about vegan food, and we love it because it's delicious, and it's good for us, and it's good for the planet. But this is more than that.
This is so much more than that. Veganism was the one aspect that he's known for promoting, and that was his passion of all the different things that you could do. But he had a wealth of ideas of how you could help the world. He encouraged people to live more naturally, like to do organic food, so not to use the chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And that's not necessarily a vegan issue. He encouraged people to preserve wildlife and natural wilderness areas. And it could be picking up litter or planting a garden or organizing some sort of neighborhood activity. Or you could be volunteering at an animal sanctuary. Or you could be teaching how to cook plant
foods,
of course.
You know what I like about this? Now, if in my world, I would love that everyone was vegan and we didn't have to kill animals, that we didn't have to kill anyone, people, anything. But I know that I'm never going to see anything like that in my lifetime. And what's good about this concept is that there are many wonderful things that every one of us can do, and we can align with people on some issues that normally we wouldn't agree with them on other issues, but we can align and do good and be compassionate with other organizations and other groups on the issues that we agree on.
Exactly.
So you talk about organic food and not using pesticides, which we're going to be talking in a lot more detail with this in the second part of this show. But we don't have to, the people that we work with, they don't have to be vegan. We mm-hmm. to work towards getting organic plant production as mainstream and stopping all of this use of toxic chemicals on the planet.
Yeah, so I think we really need to find people that we have something in common with instead of always looking at what we have different.
Yes.
And so a good example is, how often do you hear people say, oh, I would love to have, if I could have one wish, I would love to have world peace.
Uh-huh.
But what are they doing about it? And what can we do? And so my dad had some great ideas of what you really can do through dynamic harmlessness. You can build this foundation of understanding and unity and empathy. And with that, then there's a foundation for world peace. So there has to be the compassion among human beings, whether you're part of a family, a state, a nation, a race, or just part of the world. Anyone on this planet needs to have compassion for each other.
And how do we do that?
Well, that's where he came up with all sorts of ideas.
Can you give
it's
us
great
an example?
To have ideas for people. He focused on having the compassion for the animals. That was where he decided to start. And it's just a starting point. But he encouraged other people. Like, he was a huge fan of Mother Teresa, working among the poor and the unfortunate to alleviate the human misery in general. And that's something that it wasn't what he chose to do, working directly with those people, but he saw how much she did. And so he would speak very highly of her. He spoke very highly of Gandhi and everything that Gandhi was able to accomplish. I think he saw the movie Gandhi in the theaters back in the 80s, like 20-something times, maybe 30 times. They didn't have VHS tapes back then. There certainly weren't DVDs.
Or he would have owned it.
Yeah, oh, he had it memorized. He had every word of Gandhi memorized.
Wow.
In fact, our very first answering machine that we had, his first message was a Gandhi impersonation. And people got our answering machine and were very confused by it, so we had to take it off. I don't think the world was quite ready for all his dynamic harmlessness and the ways of spreading it.
So do you envision some kind of special events on Dynamic Harmlessness Day?
Well, we're just starting it out, so right now we're putting forth a lot of ideas that people can take and see what's going to work for them in their community. I've got a wonderful student who's been brainstorming with me projects that anybody can do, especially students, because that's really where this is going to start, is with the younger folk who learn about it and go, hey, that's really cool. And so they can do simple things like paint a picture, but paint a picture that illustrates dynamic harmlessness. Or select a quote from H.J. Dinshaw and write about what it means, and then share what you've written with other people. Maybe you're organizing any sort of a vegan event on Dynamic Harmlessness Day or during World Vegan Month that shines light on the importance of celebrating dynamic harmlessness. So there are lots of things that can be done. There's things just as simple as riding your bicycle instead of taking a car to reduce the amount of energy that's being used. And, of course, you'll like that we're encouraging people to buy local, organic, even veganic produce or grow their own.
Right. Now, a lot of people today are afraid because there's a lot of horrible things going on in the world. And I don't know if things are worse now than they've ever been. I don't like to look at it that way. In some way, things are better now than they've always been, but the media likes to scare us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we make a point of doing something good, something harmless, or something compassionate, I think that helps us either manage the fear that we have or make it go away.
It does. It really helps to have a positive outlook. And I know you said earlier that you don't think that we're going to have a vegan world or a peaceful, compassionate world in your lifetime. My dad had an amazing, almost childlike attitude to it. He really did truly believe that he was going to close all the slaughterhouses in his lifetime.
Mm.
He had toured a slaughterhouse. He felt the empathy for the animals. He went vegan that day because he saw dairy cows being slaughtered. And he really believed it could be done. Now, unfortunately, he didn't get it done in his lifetime, so there's still some for the rest of us to work on. But I think the same thing has to happen with dynamic harmlessness, that people need to believe it. And he used to say that he can't do everything. All he can do is what he can do each and every day. And that's really what any of us can do. But if enough of us do what we can to do the least amount of harm and the most good every day, that's going to add up to being a whole lot of good. And I think with that, we'll start making the news a lot more often than these terrible stories, and the world becomes a better place.
I agree, and that's a good place to wrap this dynamic harmless day moment right up. Thank you, Anne, for letting us know about it. And we invite everybody to go to AmericanVegan.org, find out more. And I'll see you real soon somewhere.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, remember, dynamic harmlessness. Can you say that with me? Dynamic harmlessness. Very good. I want to bring on my next guest, Michael Budke. He is the co-founder and executive director of Stop Animal Exploitation Now, SANE, S-A-E-N, which works exclusively on the animal experimentation issue by successfully terminating research projects, forcing the USDA to take legal action against laboratories and coordinating release of animals into sanctuaries. After witnessing the atrocities of animal experimentation during his education, he successfully ended a head injury experiment on cats at the University of Cincinnati, which launched his career, leading to positions with several national organizations before he co-founded SANE in the mid 1990s. Michael, how are you today?
Oh, very good. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Now, we're going to talk quickly and touch on a bunch of important things, and then we're going to have you on sometime later. But you had mentioned that you had some events coming up, so I thought it would be a good time to find out about them so people could hear about them. But I just read your little book, Tear at the Jacket, A Grim Look into America's Primate Research Labs. And I want to say I'm glad it was little, because there were so many just miserable accounts in here of what we do with animals in experimentation. And I don't know that I could have taken any more of it. But I'm glad
I understand
you told
what you're saying.
Story.
It's certainly not easy reading.
Yeah.
It's certainly not easy reading, but it's the kind of information that
I think
demonstrates very clearly exactly what happens to animals in laboratories, and especially non-human primates, although we obviously have similar and other very bad situations of abuse with many species around the U.S. and really around the world. But one of the events that you referenced earlier, which we have starting in just a couple of days, is International Primate Liberation Week, wherein we currently have 32 events, and they could be anything from protests to news conferences to other publication or public events. We have 32 events going on in 24 different cities in three nations around the world. And anyone that wants to get involved in this international event can either go to our website, which is www.saenonline.org, and there's a link to the Primate Liberation Week event posted very prominently at the top of the homepage, or they can find our Facebook page, and this way they can, literally activists anywhere can get connected with events going on in their areas, or they can gain access to the methods for registering new events with us if activists would like to put together a protest or other event in their city. We also have, and this overlaps with Primate Liberation Week, this very weekend here in the Cincinnati area, we have the Free the Animals Conference, which begins this Friday evening and runs through Saturday and Sunday and concludes Monday with a protest event. And this is a conference we've been doing. This is actually our fourth one. We've been doing it for about 2 years, 2.5 years now. And this is specifically about the vivisection issue, although the methods and the techniques that we discuss, everything from investigations and news media to how to coordinate protests, could clearly be used in virtually any issue area within the animal rights movement.
Okay. Well, the whole idea behind vivisection is really quite chilling. I think many people would believe that it's necessary because it helps provide cures for diseases for humans and teach us how to solve critical medical issues for human beings. And those that dig, and you don't even have to dig too deep, find that for most instances that really doesn't happen. And a lot of the experimentation, if you read and see what the scientists are doing, is it's just a nightmare. It's just crazy stuff that's useless and just harmful to these precious, innocent animals.
Well, that's very true, because the reality is that other species of animals are not human beings in little fur coats. They don't react the same to drugs. They don't react the same to medications. They don't suffer from many of the same diseases which are currently killing human beings and are our most significant public health concerns. And while some people that call themselves scientists have tried to replicate these specifically human conditions in other species of animals, it simply doesn't work. And that's why we don't have cures for most of the major diseases that are killing human beings right now, is because the methods that are being used aren't going to provide that information. You can't replicate a specifically human condition in other species of animals. For example, the many non-human primates are used in what is called HIV research. Well, the reality is that the H in HIV stands for human immunodeficiency virus. And that's because other species of primates aren't even subject to that virus. There is another virus which affects other species of primates, which is referred to as SIV. That's the simian immunodeficiency virus. And that one, by the way, doesn't do anything to people. And so what has very often been done is they have spliced those two viruses together and tried to use that as a method for replicating human immunodeficiency disease or HIV/AIDS in other species of primates. And the result of that is they've come out with well over 80 vaccines which were supposed to protect human beings. And not only did they not protect human beings from HIV/AIDS, they actually made, in many instances, people more subject to the disease. And that's what we keep finding time and time again, is that using animals as substitutes for human beings just simply doesn't work, because, well, think about it this way. If you have a sick animal, you don't take that animal to an MD. You take that animal to a veterinarian. But when you and I are sick, we go to medical doctors. Well, there's a reason for that. Other animals, whether we want to talk about primates, dogs, cats, rabbits, they react to things differently than you and I do. So they have to go to a different kind of medical professional. So why do we think we can generalize from them to human beings? I mean, the only place where there's any scientific validity there is when you're talking about zoonotic diseases that actually spread across species lines in roughly the same way. But the diseases that are killing human beings right now most often are not zoonotic diseases. We don't typically have large populations of people in the United States dying of diseases like rabies. And so this research doesn't work. The only people that really benefit from most animal research are those that are being paid to do it. And this is the part of the equation that most people don't understand, is that animal research in the U.S., just as it's funded by the federal government, is a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Every year in the U.S., we're spending 12, 14, in some instances as high as $15 billion a year on animal experiments, when we can't even figure out how to pay for health care for human beings. How many people could we provide health care to for $14 billion a year?
Mm-hmm. Now, in your little book, you give instances of different animals and the tests that have been done on them and their reactions and the notes that people took. Where did you get all this information?
Well, that's very detailed information, and that goes to the basis of how we work on this issue. We think that it's very important to keep our approach based 100% in facts, because we found that there's absolutely no need to exaggerate what goes on in animal laboratories. It's certainly bad enough. And so we work by using public records law, either on the federal level, the Freedom of Information Act, or on the state law. On the state level, each state has its own version of that, which allows you to obtain documents through the state laws and look at public records that are relevant to institutions such as state universities, the ones that perform animal experimentation. Well, essentially, every piece of paper they have is a public record, and you as a citizen of the United States have a right to look at those documents. And that was the basis of that book, and really is the basis of our continuing work to this day, although we use some different sources now. But, I mean, just to give you an example of how effective we've been, just in the first 9 months of this year, our work has been connected to, I believe, four laboratories being fined in the United States, including the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, which received the second largest USDA fine in history for an animal laboratory. We have been successfully getting 15 laboratories now cited for violating the Animal Welfare Act, and I believe it was either six or eight of those have now received official warnings, and we believe several of the others are going to be significantly fined. And we've just had an incident which broke. We had several major stories which broke just yesterday. One of them is about the Oregon Health Sciences University, where an animal caretaker there was actually documented to be beating one of the pigs as the animal was arriving during a shipment. And initially it was clear that OHSU was, at least some of the staff at OHSU were clearly involved in something of an internal cover-up, because despite the fact that this incident was well known within the university, it was not reported to their research integrity office nor to the National Institutes of Health, as is required, for almost 2 years. And then even when they did talk to the NIH about it, on the one hand, they were trying to make it sound like this pig was hit and there was a little trickle of blood in the enclosure. Well, the local newspaper there, actually using public records law, as we do, obtained a copy of the anonymous note through which this incident was reported, and it actually said something more to the effect of that the pig who was abused was, here, I'll read it, was witnessed by two other technicians repeatedly punching a swine in the face till it was bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a single incident where there was a trickle of blood in the cage.
Yeah. Now, the sad thing is that the regulations that we have that are supposed to protect these animals in these laboratories, those regulations aren't even good enough, and people don't even follow them.
No, they're not. It's not even close. The only law that regulates the use of animals in laboratories is the Federal Animal Welfare Act. There is no criminal component whatsoever to the Federal Animal Welfare Act, and as a result, in many instances, the only penalties assessed against laboratories are fines. And one of the problems with the fine is that in most instances, you're talking about a laboratory that's making somewhere between, on the low end, maybe $50 million a year from animal experiments, up to, in some instances, well over $100 million, and they may be fined, say, something on the order of $30,000. While that's kind of like you receiving a $3 penalty for a speeding ticket, you really wouldn't care. However, we have been successful, and I was actually a bit surprised by this myself, but this is something else that just came out yesterday. As a result of an official complaint which we filed and bringing to light an incident of deliberate water deprivation at the University of South Florida, which was not even approved or part of a protocol, the University of South Florida campus police have actually launched a criminal investigation against the university's own staff, looking to see if there was animal cruelty involved and going on in their own laboratories. And we think this is something that is literally precedent-setting.
Wow. Okay. Now, do you know about Steve Wise and the Non-Human Rights Project?
I'm familiar with them, yes. In fact, I believe I was on a panel with one of their staff members at not this year, but last year at the National Animal Rights Conference.
All right. Well, I wondered what you thought about what was going on. Tomorrow, they're actually having the New York Supreme Court Appellate Division is hearing oral arguments in their Tommy chimpanzee rights case. And it's just exciting to see what's going on and see how it's moving forward. And that their case isn't being just laughed at and dismissed, but they're actually being heard. And the idea.
Well, the interesting thing about it is, as you said, that it's even being heard. And I think that indicates that at least on some levels, the judicial system may be open to the concept that while animals would not necessarily be accorded the same legal rights that human beings are, they clearly should not be considered just as property, and there needs to be some other kind of classification provided for animals, because they clearly have interests, they have needs. Otherwise, we wouldn't have animal cruelty laws to begin with. And that being the case, their needs should be considered independent of their legal status as property, and should essentially, in the final analysis, overturn their legal status as property.
Okay, so what can we do? People can visit your website, saneonline.org. That's S-A-E-N, online.org. What else can people do to stop this nonsense?
They can certainly find us on Facebook. Just look for the name of the organization. You can use the acronym search for SANE, S-A-E-N, or Stop Animal Exploitation Now. The big thing that we want people to know is that individuals can make a difference in this issue. You don't need to be a huge animal rights organization. Well, that's clear because we're having a major impact, and our entire annual budget is less than that of individual employees of some other organizations. And the point I'm trying to make there is individuals can make a difference here. Individual people can have an impact and can help the animals in the laboratories end the abuse, and in some instances, literally stop animal experiments. And that actually comes back to what we started talking about. That's the reason we have our Free the Animals conference, is we literally want to train people how to be effective animal activists, because even just with this issue by itself, there's over 1,000 registered research facilities in the United States, and we need more people working on this issue.
Right. Thank you, Michael. Thank you so very much for your work and for speaking with me today, and we'll talk again soon.
Look forward to being back on the program as soon as it's convenient.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Yeah, have a good one. Well, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. We're going to take a very short break, and then we are going to talk about genetically modified food and pesticides and all the myths that you've been served, okay? We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. It's time for part two of It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's October 7, 2014. My next guest is the president of International Federation of Organic Agricultural Movements, IFOAM, the world umbrella body for the organic sector. IFOAM has approximately 800 member organizations in 120 countries around the world. He was the chair of the Organic Federation of Australia, the peak body for the Australian organic sector, and chair of the Far North Queensland Lychee Growers Association. He has extensive publications in outlets such as New Internationalist, the Journal of Organic Systems, Acta Horticulturae, the Journal, American Bamboo Society Journal, Heartwise, Holy Organic, The Organic Way, The Organic Standard, Ecology and Farming. He and his wife, Julia, own an organic tropical fruit orchard in Daintree, Queensland that supplies quality control fruit to local and international markets. Andre, welcome to It's All About Food. Can you tell me how to pronounce your last name? I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to say it wrong.
Okay, it's Leu, L-E-U. It's the same E-U as Freud or Deutsch. It's the German way of pronouncing
okay.
it.
Okay. I was not going to say that, Andre Leu. Well, thank you
Don't worry.
For telling me.
I get called lots of things.
I imagine. Okay, you have a new book, and it's all about the myths that we're being fed, the myths of safe pesticides. We talk about this a little bit from time to time on this program, and I'm glad that you've written what you have. Very often I focus not on the safety of genetic engineering, as an example, and it's linked to needing all the pesticides and herbicides. I talk mostly about what's wrong with farming today on so many levels. Because it's hard to find all the science, but you've put it all together in one book that shows how bad it is.
Thank you for that. It's actually, for me, this has been a very important project because most people are told that pesticides are used safely and that there's very good science behind the testing, and we have nothing to worry about with the pesticides in our food. So I really wanted to investigate that because a lot of the, you know, anecdotal evidence we have shows it's the opposite. So I started to look at the science and the published peer-reviewed science and found that there are hundreds and hundreds of studies that our regulators, such as the US EPA, are ignoring, and instead they're basing their conclusions on what I call data-free assumptions. They're making their decisions on assumptions and not on published peer-reviewed science.
Well, you know, I went to college and I became a chemical engineer. And in my training, we were always taught to assume. Whenever we were trying to figure things out, the first thing we had to do was list all our assumptions. It's like in the training, assume this and assume that. But at some point, you really have to get, you can't just make things up.
Exactly, and this is one of the things I'm putting out in my book, is that good science is on evidence-based data, and good science is where they publish it. It's in peer-reviewed journals so that other scientists can look at that data and repeat it to see if the conclusions are correct. What is happening in this case is that there are assumptions being made about the toxicology of these products they use in our food that have no basis in science. So instead of being science-based decisions, these are just data-free assumptions, which, you know, from our point of view, you know, is totally wrong, because regulators have a duty of care to protect the public from these toxic chemicals.
Now, when you're talking about pesticides, you're including the whole package, insecticides, herbicides, fungicides.
Exactly. It's all the sides.
all the sides.
All the, yeah, exactly. It's a generic word for the whole lot. So, and I explain that in my book so that people can understand when I'm using pesticides, I'm talking about all the different various compounds that are toxic compounds that are used in our food supply.
Now, one thing you mentioned in your book, which really started to give me chills, and I know that it happened, is that the little testing that we do is on singular chemicals, singular ingredients, and we live in a world where everything is mixed together and there's all different things happening, and we don't test the combinations of things that people will experience.
That's one of the key things that I point out, that the testing is based on one single ingredient in a pesticide formulation, and they call this the active ingredient. But all the products that are sold and used are formulations of many different compounds. Many of them are quite toxic, and we have very good data of what we call synergistic or additive effects, that when you add these together, they are far more toxic. And the limited testing we do have is looking at, you know, 300 to 1,000 times more toxic than the single ingredient.
That's pretty scary.
The other part is not just the fact that every registered pesticide that is used in the world is not tested for their complete formulation in terms of long-term diseases such as cancer, nerve damage, what we call toxic neurodevelopment damage in children, things that lead to things like ADHD, other behavioral problems, endocrine disruption. I can go on naming all the different types of diseases that are caused by pesticides that are not tested for. When, you know, the actual product that is sold, there is no testing for these. The other one is the fact that several different types of pesticides are approved for one crop. So, for instance, it might be several insecticides, several types of herbicides, several types of fungicides, miticides, and they're all used. And when we look at the testing of food, most products will have multiple pesticide residues, and there's no testing of those combinations either.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's expensive, and it takes a long time to do those tests, and they want to get their products out and make money.
Exactly, and of course the other side of it is it's a win-win, because of all these diseases, the same companies can sell all the cures for it as well. So
yes, the quote cures.
Exactly, so it doesn't get better than that as a business model.
Now, one of your other myths is that pesticides are essential to farming, and we hear this a lot. We hear about the Green Revolution and how wonderful it was, and now it's left us with a parched earth. Can't grow anything.
Yeah.
I was speaking with Eric Lee Mader last week from the Xerces Society. Are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not.
Well, we talked a lot about farming and beneficial insects, and just listening to what they're working on in the book that just came out, it's just incredible. What a beautiful world we can have when we choose to work with native plants, wildflowers and grasses, and encourage those insects that will do the work with us rather than against us without using pesticides.
Exactly, and I actually go into that in the book. We call this eco-function intensification, where we work with functional biodiversity and bring that into the system, and that can give you the ecosystem services such as pest control. In other words, you know, we can bring in plants that are the hosts of the beneficial insects, put that into our system, and they will control the pests without having to use toxic chemicals. And this is really the future of agriculture, that we start working with agroecology, start using ecological science to and make an agriculture that is much better for the environment. We increase the biodiversity. And what we know now, we can actually increase food production on top, and make it far greater than the amount of food that we're producing at the moment.
It's a win-win if we would only go that way. So how does it look so far? Is this message getting out there?
We have very good science at the moment showing that now that we're getting research into organic systems, that you can get much higher yields out of organic than conventional. And that includes studies in the United States where conventional is already high yielding. But the really exciting one is in the developing world where most of the hungry people live. There's about 800 million people who do not get enough food every day, and there's another billion. They get enough calories, but they don't get enough essential micronutrients, vitamins, antioxidants, minerals, etc.
That's most people in this country.
Yeah, I know. Look, it's the same. Actually, it's the same the world over now. They get more than enough empty calories,
yes,
but they don't actually get enough nutrition.
Right.
But what we know now is that around most of these people are actually smallholder farmers, and they're not producing enough food. And with good organic techniques, we're able to give them more than 100% increase in food production. And that takes these communities from abject poverty into relative prosperity.
Wow, I love that.
It's one of the really good success stories. There's a very good study done by two United Nations organizations, United Nations Environment Program and the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. And they reviewed 114 projects across Africa. And it was over 2 million hectares, that's 5 million acres, and just under 2 million farmers. And they found on average, with good organic methods, there was 114% increase in yields. And that meant that, exactly. And,
wow.
And it meant that these people now were food secure. Very importantly, they could send their children, and especially their daughters, to school. It's usually the daughters that don't get educated. They can afford medical bills. They could build nice houses. They could actually socialize. Some of the stories you hear, which you don't even think of, the women, because they can't afford decent clothing, don't want to socialize because they feel embarrassed or indecent.
Yes.
They can have nice clothing. They can socialize. You get this whole sense of community. The children start returning back to the villages because there's a future. It just changes everything around. And the thing about this is that, you know, it just needs training and education. We don't need to waste, you know, billions and billions of dollars developing a new GMO or something. You know, that money can be used to help, you know, the most marginalized people on our planet and turn it around and, you know, build really vibrant, happy, functioning communities.
That's probably the most frustrating part for me of the genetic modified science, where they say that they're doing this to feed the world, and we know how false that is. And even if they did come up with some magic plants, it's all about distribution and educating people on what to do. And without that, they're not going to change at all.
Look, exactly. And the thing is, the type of business model that they're looking at, which is, you know, agribusiness, which is big, broad acre, farm production, in the USA and Brazil, in my country, Australia, it doesn't work because, at the moment, the world is producing 2.5 times the amount of food we need. And that food is not getting to the people who need it for a very simple reason. You know, if, for instance, you use an example of a farmer, say, in Malawi in Africa, who is food insecure, it doesn't matter how much, you know, genetically modified soybeans we grow in Brazil, it won't get to them simply because it's got no money to pay for it. But a factory feedlot in China feeding cattle has got the money. And instead, what happens is those soybeans become very expensive meat for the middle and upper classes in developing countries. So it's a completely faulty model. What we have to do is go back to food sovereignty, local food systems, and improve production in the areas where, in the actual communities, where we need to increase food production.
You know, another interesting thing about there are so many benefits of organic food production versus industrial food production. I don't like to use the word conventional, which we do here in the States. There's nothing conventional about pesticides.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that it takes a lot of fossil fuels to make those chemicals, and that puts carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the environment and warms us up.
Exactly. The sort of work that's being done now looking at agriculture, the latest figures are showing that agriculture is responsible for around 30% of greenhouse gases. And a lot of that is the energy used, you know, fossil fuel energy used to make fertilizers. Also, a lot of those fertilizers then volatilize, particularly the nitrogenous ones, become even greater greenhouse gases. But we also now have very good data showing that organic systems, because we can sequester CO2 and put it in, put it into soil as organic matter, as carbon, we can reverse climate change. We can actually strip it out and, you know, turn farming from one of the major problems to one of the major solutions for climate change.
Now, one of the saddest things about pesticides is how it impacts children's health. And that doesn't get...
To me, that is the saddest and most critical thing. And I put a lot of emphasis on that in the book. And it, to me, I suppose this is probably one of the greatest crimes that our civilization is doing, is that we are affecting our next generations. And we know now that this actually affects generations to come. Problems that people are experiencing at the moment can be due to their grandmother's exposure to pesticides.
Wow.
And, you know,
we're just at the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. And what we're seeing particularly is the unborn, the fetus. They are very vulnerable to the smallest amounts of pesticides. And we know now it can be in parts per trillion. Mm-hmm. And just so that listeners can understand what a part per trillion is, if I have 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of water and I put 1 drop in that, that's a part per trillion. So, you know, what we're trying to get across here is that this idea, oh, look, it's so, you know, the levels are so small it won't hurt you, is a nonsense now with what we know with the science. And at particular times when the fetus is developing, they need those levels, small levels of hormones, parts per trillion, to develop the normal organs and tissues, say, you know, the reproductive system, the nervous and brain system, limbs, you know, body parts. And it's that sensitive. Now, if another chemical interferes with that, then it changes the way the fetus will develop. And we know that these are programming events too, so it can affect this, you know, individual for their whole life. And it is a major issue because we also know the amount of chemicals now that are crossing the placental barrier. For instance, the Environmental Working Group did a study looking at the amount of chemicals in the placental cord blood of newborns, and they found up to 232 chemicals.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's not like these chemicals just disappear and go away once we've used them.
Exactly. And this is the other really critical thing, too, because we get told, oh, the modern chemicals aren't like the bad ones, like DDT. You know, they rapidly break down. What they're not saying is many of them actually break down to these metabolites that are even more toxic. For instance, organophosphates, they break down to these auxins. And they can be 100 to 300 times more toxic than the original product. Hmm. So, yes, it's broken down, but, yes, it's far worse. and there's no testing for these metabolites.
That's right. Okay, Andre, we just have a few more minutes left, and I thought we would turn to some more positive things. And I want to know what kind of fruit you're growing in your orchard in Australia.
Okay. It is far more positive. I grow tropical fruits. So you mentioned lychees. I have a lot of different types of lychees. But the other ones I grow are fruits that mostly come from Southeast Asia, like rambutans. It's a lychee with sort of long hairs on it. People
I was just going to ask you if you grew those. I love those. I've had them in Costa Rica. I just saw them in the Whole Foods the other day, and they looked all dried up and horrible. But when you get them locally, they're lovely.
When they're fresh, they're beautiful. And the other one you would have seen in Costa Rica are the purple mangosteens, the queen of fruits. That's one of my favorites. I grow that. And the other one, which is also one of my favorites, but can be controversial for people who don't know it, is the durian, the big spiky fruit with a very strong odor.
Yes. That, I've never been fond of those.
For me and others, it's aficionado's fruit.
People go nuts over
cheese.
Them.
You either love it or, you know, and adore it, or it's
or
the
you
other
don't.
Way around.
Yes.
Because it is so strong. And then I grow a range of other fruits, but, I have about 30 acres under tropical fruit trees.
Beautiful. Well, what amazes me is when I taste fresh food, fruits and vegetables grown organically and with care. The flavors are so incredible. They taste so like nothing like you'll find in a store selling industrial conventional produce. And why do we want to miss that? Life is short. Every bite of everything should be just luscious.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think one of the sad things now is we've turn food into just a commodity when food is one of the most, you know, one of the main essential things in our life, and food is something that should be celebrated and enjoyed in every meal. And I agree, there's nothing better than fresh, good food, you know, with wonderful flavors and texture.
And color.
And color as well, I agree. Yeah.
Okay, well, we just have a minute left, and I just wanted to say again, The Myths of Safe Pesticides. This is your new book, and I'm going to use it, I think, very frequently as a resource because there's so many great facts in here cited, all these different things that have been discovered about what pesticides are doing to us all over the world. So thanks for putting that all together.
My pleasure. And look, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you when you were in New York, but I was not in New York when you were here. And
okay. No, I was in New York in a very good time because of all the climate convergence and the climate marches. So I did enjoy it. And the other thing I always enjoy is this time of year in the northeast of the States. Just absolutely glorious. So
yes.
Had a great time.
Yeah, so let's try and keep it that way. We want to keep this world beautiful. All right. Thank you, Andre Loy.
Thank you so much, Karen. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm Karen Hardglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, The Myth of Safe Pesticide. This is a very important, groundbreaking book. If you want to get all the facts, it's all in this book. So send me an email at info@realmeals.org when you have a chance. If you have any comments and questions, and visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And remember, have a delicious week.